I just wanted to welcome Dr. Shira Weiss, who hails initially from...
Detroit.
Sorry, Detroit. I have some piece of paper here. She has learned in various places, including Bravender. She graduated from Stern College. She's currently pursuing a PhD at Revel in Jewish philosophy, and she already has an Ed.D. From Azrieli. She is an adjunct professor of Jewish philosophy at Stern College and is faculty at SAR High School, where she teaches Tanakh and Jewish philosophy. And we are really excited to have her speak to us about history tends to repeat itself, exploring the contemporary lessons of Hanukkah. And without further ado, Dr. Weiss.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks so much for having me. I just want to say it's so nice to see that Midrash Yom Rishon has expanded outside of New York. As Yoni said, I'm not originally from New York, and it's really nice to have these types of learning opportunities, serious learning opportunities for women outside of New York. So I'm really pleased to be here, and I hope other communities will follow your lead as well. Today I'd like to discuss with you the modern messages that can be extracted from the Hanukkah story. As history tends to repeat itself, the miracles that we commemorate on Hanukkah have contemporary relevance to us, and therefore the lessons of Hanukkah can be internalized today as much as they have been in the past. So let's begin by recounting the history of Hanukkah in order to understand the relevance of its messages today. In the time of the first Beit Mikdash, Babel came to power and defeated Yehuda and destroyed the first Beit Mikdash, the Holy Temple, exiling all of Bnei Israel out of Jerusalem. And Bnei Israel were exiled to many countries, but the majority of the Jews went to Babel, and there, for 70 years, they remained in exile. Now, the Nevi'im had foretold that this was going to happen, that they would be exiled for 70 years, and then they would be allowed to return and rebuild the Beit Mikdash. And the Nevi'im's prophecies actually came true. When the Persians came to power, they defeated Babel, they came to power, and gave Bnei Israel permission to return to Jerusalem. However, the problem was that while some Jews did return, the majority of Jews did not, preferring to stay in what had become their comfortable surroundings in exile, and therefore didn't go back to rebuild Beit Mikdash. Sounds a little bit familiar. So slowly, the Jews who had returned rebuilt the Beit Mikdash, but they weren't numerous enough to be autonomous. So they remained under the rule of the Persian Empire for a brief time until the conquest of Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire. So now, Alexander the Great was advised to destroy Jerusalem because it was claimed that the Jews were being disloyal. He, however, decided to spare Jerusalem and the Beit Mikdash, and he tried to create a global, universal culture that would bind his empire together. And therefore, he blended the Greek religions and tried to spread this new culture to the Jews. Many of the Jews enthusiastically embraced it, and they became known as Hellenists. However, after Alexander's death, the Jews fell under the control of the Ptolemaic Empire, ruled by Antiochus, who forced all of the Jews to assume the Greek religion. So even more Jews abandoned their faith in order to assimilate and accept Hellenism. And those who refused to give up their freedom to study, to teach, and to practice Judaism had to undergo tremendously barbaric punishments, which often led to death. So Antiochus and his army defiled the Beit Mikdash, and they used it as a pagan temple, forcing many Jews to bow down to Greek idols there. That's when Matityahu rose to this occasion. Matityahu HaChashmonai, he was a Kohen, and he arose and organized the revolt, which was led by his son, Yehuda HaMakabi, whose rallying cry was, Mila Hashem Elai, whoever is with Hashem, he should join me and fight against the Greeks. And they demonstrated passion and courage as they fought the Greeks against overwhelming odds, and they won many battles, which enabled them to reclaim the Temple Mount and to restore the ability to practice Judaism. And they showed tremendous commitment to tradition by risking their lives in order to restore the ability to worship freely. The entire country, including Yerushalayim, was still under the control of the Greeks. They, however, miraculously were able to defeat the control, to take control of the Temple Mount. And therefore, they were given the ability to cleanse and purify the Beit Mikdash, dismantle the defiled Mizbeach, and they resumed the temple service and performed the Chanukah ceremony. Chanukah means a rededication. They had an 8-day rededication ceremony, which enabled them to restore the regular worship, and that included the Nes Pach HaShemen, the lighting of the Temple Menorah, which miraculously lasted for 8 days. So the holiday of Chanukah is celebrated to commemorate the restoration of the Jews to their homeland and to their temple, and the victory of free worship over the negative influences of assimilation. That's why we include in our tefillah what you see in source number one, the Al Hanisi prayer, which essentially is an expression of our gratitude to Hashem for such a victory. If you look in source number one, we see Bala Nisim, Bala Korkan, Bala Gvurot, Bala Tshuot, Bala Mnifla'ot, Shasita Lavotene, Bayimim Ha'im, Bazman Hazeh. We incorporate into our Shmona Esrei and also into our Benchin the recounting of all of the Nisim that Hashem did for us in this time. In the time of Matityahu, when the Greek kingdom rose up against Bnei Israel and tried to cause them to forget their Torah and to be over, to violate the commandments, you, Hashem, stood up for Bnei Israel in their time of Tzara, in their time of trouble. Raftet Rivam Danta Dinam Nakamtet Nakamatam Sartik Rim Bel Khalashim Rabim Biamatim Utmim Beatorim Rashim Beatrikim Vizidim Biat Oskator Techa. And with Hashem's help, Bnei Israel were able, the few were able to defeat the numerous, the weak were able to defeat the strong. And they were able to restore the Kedusha to Yerushalayim. Ulacha Asit Hashem Gadol V'Kadosh B'Olamecha Olamcha Yisrael Asit Teshuva Gedola For Kan Kiyom Hazeh. So with Hashem's miraculous redemption, with Hashem's help, in Israel were able to restore their faith, restore their worship, and they were able to restore the Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash, v'tiyiruot mikdashecha, they repurified the Beit HaMikdash, v'haliku nerot v'chatzur kedashecha, they relit the temple menorah, and they established these 8 days of Chanukah, lehodot ulaleh l'shibcha gadol, to thank Hashem, to praise Hashem for such a victory. Now the Maccabee heroes, who we celebrate on Chanukah, served as paradigms of passion and commitment in Jewish history. Sadly, however, the threat of assimilation that they abolished was not permanent. Throughout history, the cycle repeated itself. The Second Temple, too, was destroyed, and we find ourselves in a current exile needing to reflect upon the models of our ancient heroes. Shir HaShirim, the Megillah that we read on Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach, recounts in allegorical form this cycle of closeness and distance from Hashem that we as a people have experienced throughout our history. Shir HaShirim is a dialogue of a love poem between a male and female lover, the Dod and the Raya. The love that's described in the Megillah is a very passionate yet unstable love. And the male and female characters had once been very united in their love, but have since been separated, and they describe their love for each other and their yearning desire to reunite. Now, the first 4 prakim of Megillah describe the male searching and longing to find his beloved, and then the female searching and longing to reunite with him as well. After all of this description of their love for one another and their desperate searches for each other, finally, in source number 2, in Perek Hay of Shir HaShirim, the male character finds the tent of his lover. If you look in source number 2, Ani Yashena, the female character is speaking. She says, I am asleep, v'libi air, but my heart is awake. Kol dodi dofek, the voice of my beloved knocks. Pitchi li achoti rayati yonati timati, sheroshi nimlatal kvutatai resise laila. He says to her, she hears him from outside her door. He says to her, he calls out to her, Pitchi li achoti, open for me the door, rayati yonati, open for me, my beloved. Finally, I found you. Finally, after all of this pent up searching and longing for one another, finally we're able to reunite. Sheroshinim natal kvusatirisi se laila. My head is dripping with dew, right? I've been searching throughout all of the night. Finally, I found you. So what would you expect her response to be? You would expect her to lunge out of bed, jump into his arms. Finally, finally, their love can be reunited. However, for some explicable reason, we see a very different response from her in Pasuk Gimel. Look at Pasuk Gimel. She says, "Pishatti et kutunati echichal b'shana, rachatti et regli echichat anfeim." She says, "I've already taken off my coat. I've already gotten into bed. How should I now get dressed again? I've already washed my feet. How should I now dirty them?" So even though you would have expected her to be so enthusiastic, so passionate about the opportunity to reunite with her lover, we see for some unexplicable reason, we see her reluctance. Dodi shalach yado min achor ma'ehem walai. But the dod, but the male character doesn't give up. He sticks his finger through the keyhole. She sees him right beyond the door. Uma'ai hamu alav. She describes her innards kind of like yearning for him from inside of her. So finally, after her initial reluctance, she gets up out of bed. She had put lotion on her hands before she had gone to bed. So when she's trying to open the door, we see that her hands are slipping and she's unable. Finally, in Pasuk Vav, she's able to open the door and finally reunite with her beloved. Pitachti ani ledodi, vadodi chamakavar. Finally, she opens the door, but her beloved is no longer there. She searches for him, but can't find him. She calls after him, but nobody answers. מצאני השומרים הסבבים בעיר הקונים פצעוני נצאו את רציתים אליי של מחומות השבעתי אתכם בנות ירושלים ומצאו את עודי מה תגידו לו שחולת אהבה אני. So then she resumes her search all over again. She searches through the streets, asks the shomrim, asks the other of the Banot Yerushalayim, the other women in the city. She says, "If you see my beloved, ma tegidulo, what should you tell him? Tell him shecholat ahava ani. Tell him I am lovesick for him." So because of the romantic nature of the love poem, many midrashim, as well as many classical mefarshim, interpret the Megillah allegorically. That the Torah, that the text is not supposed to be taken literally as a love poem between a man and a woman, but rather the man and the woman really represent the relationship between Hashem and Bnei Israel. Hashem is the man, and Bnei Israel is depicted as the woman. Rambam says that we have to learn how to love God from our only experience of love. We can only experience love on the human level, so that is how we have to project our love to God. And if you look in Rambam in Hilchot Tshuva, Perek Yud Halacha Gimel, he says, how can man achieve ha'ava haruya? How can man achieve the appropriate love for God? Hu she'ahavat Hashem ava gedola yitara azam ma'od, ad shetei nafsho kashura ba'avat Hashem. Just like when a man loves a woman, his soul is completely bound to that woman. His thoughts are completely preoccupied with the woman. He can't eat, he can't sleep, he can't go about his business without thinking of his beloved. That, but even stronger, should be our love for God. If you look in the second to the last line there, he says, Yoter mizeh tiyeh ahavat Hashem b'lev o'avav shogim batamid, kamo shetzivanu b'chol v'v'chol v'chol nafshecha. That's what it means, the pasuk, when you say you should love Hashem with all of your heart and with all of your soul. This is what Shlomo meant when he wrote Shir Shirim, when he wrote in that last pasuk in source number 2, Shecholat Ava Ani. That is the lovesickness that Bnei Israel are supposed to feel for Hashem. The whole Shir Shirim, Rambam says, Mashal Hu L'Inyan Zeh. And all of Shir Shirim should be understood as a mashal, as a parable, as an allegory to depict this love relationship between Hashem and Bnei Israel. Now, while passion can be extremely positive and it can often encourage us or act as a strong motivator for us to act, at times passion burns out. And as we saw in the case of the female character in Shir Shirim, who is reluctant to open the door to reunite with her beloved, we see that she regains her passion only after her beloved is no longer accessible. And so we see that passion without commitment is inconsistent and leaves her quite unfulfilled. According to this allegorical interpretation, the periods of alternating closeness and distance from God, or between the male and female characters, represents the time when Bnei Israel feel close and distant from God. Right? These are the times, these alternating periods, during which Bnei Israel reject God and thereby distance themselves from Hashem, and then when they feel closer to God once again. And whether on a personal or on a national level, B'nai Israel's relationship with God throughout history has always been characterized by this cycle of intense search and desire, then followed by our rejection of him, which in turn leads us again to an even more intense and passionate search. So satisfaction and stability are never quite achieved, but the relationship is perpetually comprised of this search, rejection, loss, and then search once again. Rashi, in source number 4, as well as many other biblical mefarshim, further interpret the psukim of Shir Shirim according to this allegorical interpretation. If you look at source number 4, he takes the psukim that we just saw in source number 2, and he interprets them on an allegorical level. He says, Ani Sheina, that's referring to B'nai Yisrael. Again, the woman is representing B'nai Yisrael. So when the woman says, Ani Sheina, she's tired, she's in bed, she's reluctant to open the door for her beloved. That Rashi interprets as, Kesheyiti shalva v'shaketet b'bayit rishon, no'ashti mi'abud HaKadosh Baruch Hu ki yishena v'nir demet. That represents B'nai Yisrael being very neglectful of their worship of Hashem. It was as if they were tired, it was as if they were lazy during the time of Bayit Rishon, they weren't zealous enough in their avodah. V'libi er, that's Hashem, is trying to motivate us, trying to inspire us. Kol dodi dofek, the knock of the beloved on her door, represented by the male, mashrash shchinato al nevi'im asir al yedeim Hashem v'shiluach, that's the shchina, Hashem, telling the nevi'im to motivate B'nai Israel to improve their behavior. And when he calls out to her, despite B'nai Israel's initial reluctance, when the male calls out to her, and he says, Pitchili, open for me the door, my beloved, that's Hashem calling out to B'nai Israel, saying, Al tergami li shestalek milecha, don't cause me to withdraw myself from you. So we don't only see this figurative interpretation in these psukim, in the parshanut of the psukim, but we also see this allegorical interpretation in medieval Jewish philosophy as well. In source number 5, Yehuda Halevi, in medieval times, in the 11th century, wrote the Sefer Kuzari. And the Sefer Kuzari was a medieval Jewish philosophical work that was intended to teach the truths of Judaism, both in terms of the tenets, as well as in terms of the history and practice. And the premise of Yehuda Halevi's work was that a Khazar king went out to investigate the true religion in the world. First, he inquired from the Aristotelian philosophers. Dissatisfied with their responses, he inquired to the Christians and then the Muslims. When he was still dissatisfied, he finally went to pursue the truths of the Jewish religion. And the chaver, or the rabbi who described it, this is Yehuda Halevi's voice in the Kuzari, explained the history and the beliefs of Judaism, which ultimately was the religion that was convincing as legitimate to the Khazar king. In this particular excerpt in source number 5, Yehuda Halevi describes to the king an aspect of Jewish history and interprets, in the same allegorical way as we just saw Rashi, interprets those psukim in source number 2 from Shir Shirim. Have a look in source number 5. He says, it's the sin which kept the divine promise with regard to the Second Temple. Divine Providence was ready to restore everything as it had been at first, if they had all willingly consented to return. But only a part was ready to do so, whilst the majority and the aristocracy remained in Babel, preferring dependence and slavery and unwilling to leave their houses and their affairs. An allusion to them might be found in the enigmatic words of Shlomo, I sleep, ani yishena v'libi er, but my heart wakes. He designates the exile by sleep and the continuance of prophecy among them by the wakefulness of the heart. Kol dodi dofek, it's the voice of my beloved that knocks, means God's call to return. My head is filled with dew, what the male protagonist says. That alludes to the Shekhinah, which emerged from the shadow of the temple. The words, the Raya's words, the woman's words, I've already taken off my coat, that refers to the people's slothfulness, their laziness in consenting to return. And the pasuk, my beloved stretched forth his hand through the opening in the door, that may be interpreted as the urgent call of Ezra and Nehemiah and the prophets until a portion of the people grudgingly responded to their invitation. In accordance with their mean mind, they did not receive full measure. Divine providence only gives man as much as he is prepared to receive. If his receptive capacity be small, he obtains little, and much if it be great. Were we prepared to meet the God of our forefathers with a pure mind, we should find the same salvation as our fathers did in Mitzrayim. So this idea of Bnei Israel's rejection of God in history was not only prevalent in medieval times, but similar sentiments were expressed by Rav Soloveitchik in contemporary times as well. In 1956, on Yom HaAtzma'ut, Rav Soloveitchik, who was then the Rosh Yeshiva of YU, gave his annual Yom HaAtzma'ut drasha. And he entitled that drasha, Kol Dodido Feik, the voice of my beloved Nax, right from our pasuk in source number 2. And using the allegorical interpretation, the Rav compares the distance between the male and the female in Shir Shirim to God's Hester Panim, to God's hiding of his face during the Holocaust, and interprets God's establishment of Medina Israel as God's knocking on our door like the male knocking on the female's tent. If you look in source number 6, Rav Soloveitchik writes, 8 years ago, in the midst of a night of terror filled with the horrors of Majdanek, Treblinka, and Buchenwald, in a night of gas chambers and crematoria, in a night of absolute divine self-concealment, Hester Panim Uchlat, in a night ruled by the Satan of doubt and apostasy, which sought to sweep the maiden from her house into the Christian church, in a night of continuous searching, of questing for the beloved, in that very night the beloved appeared. God, who conceals himself in his dazzling hiddenness, suddenly manifested himself and began to knock at the door of his despondent and disconsolate love, twisting convulsively on her bed, suffering the pains of hell. As a result of the knocks on the door of the maiden, wrapped in mourning, the state of Israel was born. So in that first paragraph, he explains how the Hester Panim, that was Hashem hiding his face, allowing the terrors of the Holocaust to occur. Now, the Dod and the Raya, the male and female protagonists from the Shir Shirim, finally have the opportunity to unite. The male is knocking on her door, which Rav Soloveitchik allegorically interprets as God knocking on our door to reunite with us after the Holocaust in the establishment of the State of Israel. But look at how he continues. What was our reaction to the voice of the beloved that knocks, to God's bounteous kindnesses and wonders? Did we descend from our couches and immediately open the door? Or did we, like the woman in Shir Shirim, continue to rest and tarry rather than descend from our beds? American Jewry could certainly have accelerated the process of colonization. The obligation to pay close attention to the voice of my beloved that knocks and to respond to him immediately with mighty deeds and undertakings devolves precisely upon us who are faithful to traditional Judaism. When the desolate wife who had awaited us with such yearning and for so long invited us, her sons, to come and redeem her from her desolate condition, and when the beloved, who had watched over the desolation for almost 1900 years, and who had decreed that not a tree would flourish there, that no springs would fructify its ground, knocked on the doors of his love, the maiden, we religious Jews, did not rush to descend from her couch and let in her beloved. Can we not hear in our own concern for the peace and security of the land of Israel today, again, he wrote this in 1956, the knocking of the beloved, pleading with his love that she let him enter. He has already been knocking for more than 8 years and still has not received a proper response. Nevertheless, he continues to knock. We have been fortunate. The beloved did not show any special regard to his cherished darling, but God continues to wait for us. On that fateful night, the maiden's beloved knocked on the door of her tent for only a brief moment and then disappeared, while he, God, treats us with extreme patience. It's 8 years now that he has been knocking. Would that we might not miss the moment. Many have argued that the sentiments that Rav Soloveitchik expressed in 1956 still, to some extent, apply today. Perhaps we need to reflect back upon the messages of the Rashi and the Kuzari and their allegorical interpretation and reflect upon how Bnei Israel did not appreciate their spiritual center when they had it, which caused the destruction of the first temple and the lack of enthusiasm to rebuild the second. Elsewhere in Rav Soloveitchik's Tshuva Drashot, the Rav describes the challenge of appreciating what one has when they have it, like the woman in Shir Shirim. If you look in source number 7, in Al HaTshuva, which is written, the Tshuva Drashos are written by Rav Soloveitchik, but they were compiled by his student Pinchas Peli. Rav Soloveitchik writes, there seems to be a tragic flaw inherent in the nature of man, from which no one can escape. The people and things that we love and cherish most are not fully appreciated as long as they are alive and present with us. We realize what they meant to us only after they are gone and their image has become faded and unreal. They seem to twinkle from afar as the stars in the night. We admire them, but cannot touch them. How many near and dear ones did we have whom we did not succeed in appreciating fully as long as they were with us? The penitent, somebody who sins and does tshuva, undergoes a similar experience. When a Jew sins, he banishes God from his presence. At first, man may not sense what has happened. He may not realize what has actually occurred. This happens to anyone who has lost someone dear to him. The same thing applies in the spiritual realm, when God has departed from man in the wake of his sins. However, while our longings are a fantasy, for one who has died will never return, longing for God is realistic, and man is drawn to him and rushes towards him with all of his strength. Just as the female lover's renewed passion motivated her to initiate another search for her beloved, so too, on the allegorical level, we should be motivated to strengthen our own relationships with God. Now, we read the Megillah of Shir Shirim on Pesach when we commemorate how Bnei Israel passionately followed Moshe out of Mitzrayim. But just as the woman's passion for her beloved was short-lived, demonstrated by her reluctance to open the door, so too, once Bnei Israel entered the Midbar, the desert, that passion and enthusiasm with which Bnei Israel left Mitzrayim somewhat dwindled and lacked commitment. When things became tough for the Jews in the desert, Bnei Israel on several occasions didn't demonstrate any loyalty to God, but rather rejected him, preferring to return to their enslaved existence in Mitzrayim. Now, Megillat Rut, read on Shavuot, can be viewed as the complement and the counterpoint to Shir Shirim, in that it presents an ideal love that's rooted in responsibility and an undying faithfulness, in contrast to Shir Shirim's depiction of a passionate but somewhat inconsistent love. Megillat Rut, like Shir Shirim, is also a love story, but it's a very different type of love story. Here, all the instances of love, the love of Rut for Naomi, of Rut for her dead husband Mahlon, the love shared between Rut and Boaz, these are all examples of love based on commitment, devotion, and loyalty. In fact, the love story of Rut begins when Rut's husband dies, precisely when the reader would expect it to end. So the themes of the Megillah, the value of loyalty and commitment, are really seen throughout the entire narrative. And the Midrash even explains that the reason for the death of Elimelech, which is described in the first three psukim of the Megillah, is because he left Eretz Israel in a time of famine, failing to demonstrate loyalty to Hashem, his people, and his land. If you look in source number 8, we see at the very bottom of the source words in bold, Kach Elimelech haya migdolei hamedinam v'rasei hador, v'keshavo shenei ra'avon, אמר עכשיו כל ישראל מסביבים פתחי, זה בקבתו וזה בקבתו, אמר וברך לו מבניהם, and that's why it says, וילך איש מבית לחם יהודה. The Midrash interprets the Elimelech's leaving Beit Lechem as an expression of his neglect. Elimelech was Migdolei Hamdina. He was one of the most prominent men in the land. He was one of the most famous in his generation. He was a true leader of the people. However, when things got tough, instead of using his leadership qualities and his commitment, he abandoned it. When things got tough with the famine, he didn't use this opportunity to help his people and to instill faith in his people, but rather he upped and left and fled from the difficult times. And that, the Midrash explains, is why Elimelech died at the beginning of the Sefer. So in contrast to the lack of commitment expressed by Elimelech, the other two main characters in the Megillah, Boaz and Rut, display the utmost loyalty and commitment. After Naomi's two sons died, Mahlon and Chilion, Rut, her Moabiah daughter-in-law, her Moabite daughter-in-law, refused to go back to her homeland, and instead insisted on remaining with her mother-in-law, even if that limited her opportunity to remarry. And Rut displayed this undying devotion to Naomi throughout Perek Aleph. If you look with me in source number 9, Perek Aleph Pasuk Chet, V'tomer Naomi l'shtei chaloteha, lechna, shovna, isha levet ima, ya'as Hashem imachem chesed, kasher asitim imemetim ve'imadi. Naomi says to her two daughter-in-laws, after the death of her two sons, she says, I have nothing left for you. Go back to the house of your mother. Hashem should do kindness with you, just as you've done this kindness with my dead sons and with me. Yitein Hashem lachem etzenem minucha isha b'tisha v'tishak lehem v'tasene polan v'tivkena. And she says Hashem should grant you menucha, rest, you should find new husbands, you should build a new life for each other. She kissed both of them goodbye and she wept. V'tomarna la ki itach nashuv amech. But they said, no, we want to return with you. We want to return to your people. V'tomar na'ami, shov na benoti, lama telech na'imi, ha'od li banim b'ma'ai v'ayu lachem na'nashim? And Naomi says, don't be ridiculous. You've already shown me a lot of chesed. I appreciate your loyalty, but there's nothing left for you. I can't give you anything else. Go and establish lives for yourself. She says, do I have any more children in my womb that can be husbands for you? Don't come with me. I have nothing to give you. Shov na benotei talachna, ki zakanti miot la'ish, ki amarti yesh li tikva, gam hayita ala la'ish, gam biyam, v'gam yilarati banim. Halahen tashaber na ad asher yigdalu, halahen tagena levilti hayot la'ish al benotai, ki mar li ma'od mikem, ki yatsa biyad Hashem. So she says, even if I were to get married tomorrow and have children, would you really wait for them to be your husbands? Don't be ridiculous. Go back, establish a new life for yourself. You don't have to come with me. So in this further persuasion to get her daughter-in-laws to go back and start a new life for themselves, Orpah, one of her daughter-in-laws, agreed. She went back to the house of her mother, but Ruth showed this undying commitment to Naomi, and she clung to her. V'tomer, hinei sheva yivimtech al ama v'elohea, shuva achorei yivimtech. So she says, stop this already. Go, follow your sister-in-law. Go back to your mother's house. V'tomer Ruth. Ruth is still unpersuaded. She says in Pasuk Tzayin, al tifki'i bilazvech l'shuv mecharach, ki al asher telchi elech, v'asher talin alim, amech ami elohayech elohai, v'asher tamuti amut, v'sham mekaber, v'cho yaseh Hashem li, v'cho yosif, ki amavet yafri b'ni yovenech. She is completely refusing to acquiesce to Naomi's attempts to dissuade her. She says, no, don't push me away. Don't tell me to return from you. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you sleep, I will sleep. Your nation is my nation. Your God is my God. And nothing will separate us until death. So we see here that Chazal even model this halachic process of gerus, of conversion, from this paradigm that Ruth expresses here. Even though Naomi tried to dissuade her many times, so too in the halachic process of gerut, we try to dissuade the potential converts in order to assess their level of allegiance. And Ruth here demonstrates the paradigm of commitment both to Naomi as well as to Judaism. However, not only does Naomi recognize Ruth's commitment, but Boaz does as well. And we see that in a later parak. If you look in the bottom, on a parak gimel, we see in Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph, V'yom mabrucha at la'ashem b'ti heitev tachastech hacharon min ha'rishon levilti lechet acharei ha'bachurim imdal v'im asher v'ata b'ti al tiri kol asher tomru aseh lach ki yodeh kol sha'ar ami ki eshet chayel at. Not only does Ruth demonstrate this commitment to Naomi by going out, following her back to Israel, going out and providing with her, gathering the grain in order to provide to satiate her mother-in-law, but she also wants to perform Yibum. She wants to marry the relative of her late husband in an effort to rebuild the legacy in the name of her late husband. And we see Boaz acknowledging this. Not only have you done this chesed for Naomi, now you're not going to find another husband, somebody younger, somebody that you love, but you're willing to marry me. Boaz is a relative of Mahlon. You want to marry me in order to do this even greater chesed for your family. So Boaz demonstrates commitment not only to Ruth by being willing to marry her, but to the halachic process as well. Even though he did want to marry Ruth, he controlled his passion in order to demonstrate his commitment in an appropriate way, by giving the first opportunity to do the Yibum to the Goel, to the closest relative to Ruth's late husband, Mahlon. Now, the halacha of Yibum is that if a man passes away without any kids, his brother, the late husband's brother, has the opportunity to do Yibum, and therefore enable his late brother's name to live on. If there's no brother, and we know that Mahlon's brother, Chilion, also died, then the Yibum opportunity goes to the next closest relative. Boaz was not the next closest relative. There was a relative in between. So even though Boaz wanted to marry Ruth, he restrained himself in order to give the Goel, the closest relative, the first opportunity to do so. And we see this in the very bottom of the page in Psukim Yud Bet and Yud Gimel. Boaz says, "V'ata ki amnam ki Goel anochi v'gam yesh Goel krov mimeni." You're right that I am a relative of Mahlon's. I do have the ability to perform this Yibum, but there is somebody closer than me. Lini halayla v'ya b'boker im yigalech tobik al, v'im lo yachpot l'gealech ugaltich, anochi Hashem, anochi chay Hashem, shechvi ad ha'boker. So he says, yes, I can do the geula, I can do this redemption, I can do the Yibum, but there's somebody that has the first opportunity. If he wants to do it, he can be the Goel. If he refuses, then I will do it. And it's only after the Goel, this closest relative, declines, is Boaz able to consummate his passion. And we see that in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud. V'gam et ru'ut ha'moavia, eshet machlon, keniti li l'isha, lahakim shem ha'met al nachalato, v'lo yekaret shem ha'met me'imachav, u'mishar mekomo, edim atem hayom. So it's only after it's mutar for Boaz to consummate this marriage that he takes Ruth as a wife, and he does it in a halachic way in front of edim. Now, the value of using commitment to channel passion is described in a halachic context by Rav Soloveitchik in his essay Catharsis, and that you'll see in source number 10. Heroism in Greek literature is often connoted by boldness, by passion. The Rav, however, in his essay explains that true heroism, from the halachic perspective, demands commitment, which must sometimes manifest itself through retreat, through restraint. Catharsis, in source number 9, in this particular, let's just start with the first paragraph. He says, what's heroism in the halacha? What does the halacha recommend to us, that we may attain heroic stature? The answer is, one must perform the dialectical movement. The halacha catharsis expresses itself in paradoxical movement in two opposite directions, in surging forward boldly and in retreating humbly. Man's heroic experience is a polar, antithetic one. Man drives forward only to retreat and to reverse, subsequently, the direction of his movement. Halacha teaches that at every level of our total existential experience, the aesthetic hedonic, meaning the physical realm, the emotional, the intellectual, and the moral religious, one must engage in this dialectical movement by alternately advancing and retreating. In the first example, in the physical realm, Rav Soloveitchik gives an illustration of how halacha sometimes demands us to restrain ourselves, to restrain our passions. And he describes the situation of a chupat nida, where a man and a woman, finally when they get married, are halachically able to consummate their marriage. However, it's at that point that the woman realizes that she's in nida. Look at how Rav Soloveitchik describes it. Bride and bridegroom are young, physically strong, and passionately in love with each other. Both have patiently waited for this rendezvous to take place. Just one more step, and their love would have been fulfilled, a vision realized. Suddenly, the bride and groom make a movement of recoil. He, gallantly, like a chivalrous knight, exhibits paradoxical heroism. He takes his own defeat. There's no glamour attached to his withdrawal. The latter is not a spectacular gesture, since there are no witnesses to admire and to laud him. The heroic act did not take place in the presence of jubilating crowds. No bards will sing of these two modest, humble young people. It happened in the sheltered privacy of their home, in the stillness of the night. The young man, like Jacob of old, makes an about-face. He retreats at the moment when fulfillment seems assured. This kind of divine dialectical discipline is not limited to man's sexual life, but extends to all areas of natural drive and temptation. The hungry person must forego the pleasure of taking food, if it's not kosher, no matter how strong the temptation. Men of property must forego the pleasure of acquisition, if the latter is halachically and morally wrong. In a word, halacha requires of man that he possess the capability of withdrawal. Of course, as we have made evident above, man is called following the movement of withdrawal to advance once again toward full victory. So just like the bridegroom, Boaz, too, didn't act on pure passion. Rather, he demonstrated both his commitment and responsibility by channeling his passion in an appropriate manner. So through all of these examples in Megillat Rut, we see that the Megillah presents a complement to Shir Shirim by portraying an ideal love that's based upon responsibility and faithfulness and not just based upon passion and hopeful love, as depicted in Shir Shirim. The relationship of Pesach to Shavuot is parallel to the relationships of the Megillot to each other. Where Pesach celebrates the promise of liberation and establishment of God's relationship with his passionate chosen nation, Shavuot celebrates Matan Torah, the giving of the mitzvot, that reflects the commitment that grounds that relationship. Pesach and Shavuot respectively represent passion and responsibility. Together, both are integral components of our service of God. Now, the Torah links Pesach and Shavuot by commanding us to count Sfirat HaOmer, to count the 7 weeks between them. There's no actual date given in the Torah for Shavuot. It's just described as 7 weeks after Pesach. So Pesach and Shavuot need each other. Each would be incomplete without the other. In the same way, our lives are complete only when we fuse a passionate and uncompromising vision of our goals and ideals with the commitment and dedication to achieve them. Passion without commitment lacks consistency. Commitment without passion lacks meaning. The values of passion and commitment that served as the building blocks for Bnei Israel at the inception of their nationhood, at Yitziat Mitzrayim, and at Matan Torah, were the same values demonstrated by the Maccabees centuries later. Yehuda HaMaccabee courageously led his revolt against the Greek Hellenists to teach the world that the Jews are passionately committed to preserving their tradition. They refused to succumb to the pressures of their surrounding nations, and they fought with God's help for the freedom to worship God in the Beit HaMikdash. As we retrospectively look back at the cycles of Jewish history in our current Galut, it's striking how these ideals still have a lot of relevance today. The yearning between the lovers in Shir Shirim, reflecting the passionate relationship between Hashem and Bnei Israel, is integral. However, the problem in the Megillah and throughout history is that such passion has been short-lived and has led to a lot of missed opportunities. We need to maintain that passion through commitment. And it was the faithful relationship between Boaz and Ruth that produced the Davidic dynasty that will ultimately lead to the Mashiach and the fulfillment of our spiritual potential. With faith in God and dedication to our tradition, the small group of Maccabees were able to recognize and act upon their opportunity within history. Only if we all follow their model by actualizing both our personal and national potentials with renewed passion and commitment will we merit a permanent and redemptive victory. Thank you all for coming.